So yeah, so these are just a few reflections that I've had while studying the material on the pleasures of the path in the Pali Canon particularly. There was so much in the Pali Canon that I just gave up the attempt to start looking at the Mahayana Sutras as well. Although there is my old favourite, which is the story of Jagatindra from Vimalakirti Nadesha. Anyway. So just a few things that I a way of introduction into this theme from looking at the scriptures. So the first thing is that it's very much Punti's emphasis, right from the days when he wrote the Survey of Buddhism, that the spiritual life is characterised by unfolding positivity. And that in a way he was quite shocked that so few commentators drew out the spiral path. So particularly when he talks about the spiral path, he talks about it as a, you know, unfolding of positive mental states rather than just what he calls via negativa, the absence of negative mental states. It's also characterized by unfolding positive states. So I think one of the things to draw attention to is the version of the spiral path that talks about the spiral path as arising without an act of will. So just to quote it, the Buddha says that bhikkhus, for a virtuous person, one whose behaviour is virtuous, no volition need to be exerted, let non-regret arise in me. It is natural, which is a translation of Dharmata, that non-regret arises in a virtuous person and one whose behaviour is virtuous. He goes on to say, it is natural that joy arises in one without regret. Rapture arises in one who is joyful. One with a rapturous mind is tranquil. One tranquil in body feels pleasure. The mind of one feeling pleasure is concentrated. One who is concentrated knows and sees things as they really are. One who knows and sees things as they really are is disenchanted and dispassionate. And one who is disenchanted and dispassionate realizes the knowledge and vision of liberation. It's Anguttara Nikaya 10.2. So what's the significance of the spiral path put in this formulation? I think what it means is that concentration and wisdom arise naturally on the basis of joy, rapture, calm and bliss. And that they are essential conditions for concentration and wisdom to arise. So we need to experience pleasure in our spiritual life. And if we do experience pleasure in our spiritual life, then concentration, meditation and wisdom will arise naturally from that. We don't have to force samadhi and pranayama to happen. They'll arise naturally on the basis of pleasure, pleasure in the spiritual life. Which is important because I think there is a general view about religion that one shouldn't experience pleasure, that pleasure is a kind of, well actually I'll talk about this later, but it's a kind of low, vulgar, vile kind of thing, and the spiritual life is beyond all that. But actually, it is also about experiencing pleasure. It doesn't have to be a sort of grim slog. In fact, the Buddha said that if anyone asks if his followers are addicted to pleasure-seeking, they should say yes. Yes, we are addicted to pleasure-seeking. The pleasure of the four jhanas. and he says, these four kinds of life devoted to pleasure are entirely conducive to disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, tranquility, realization, enlightenment, nibbana. So there you go. I didn't realize I was addicted to pleasure. And maybe my spiritual life would be a hell of a lot easier if I was more addicted to it. And the pleasure found therein. So yes, and then the fruits, he goes on to say, the fruits of these four forms of pleasure-seeking are breaking the fetters, so becoming a stream entrant, a non-returner, a once-returner and a non-returner. Yeah, so it's okay to look for pleasure in the spiritual life. And to look for pleasure as a benefit of practice. The Buddha also said, develop the wholesome. If this developing of the wholesome led to harm and suffering, I would not tell you to develop it. But because the developing of the wholesome, or skillful as we would say, leads to welfare and happiness, I say, develop this, the wholesome. So in a way, it's a vital part of spiritual life, and it's okay to have that as a kind of motivation, to be addicted to the pleasures of the spiritual life even. And, you know, particularly in that reference, the path of ethics is not about, you know, not doing what you want to do and feeling thoroughly miserable. It's about actually becoming happier. So that's why we're doing what we're doing. We're doing it part of the motivation is to live a happier life, but also to make other people happy. And I think it's easy to lose sight of this in the midst of our responsibilities. I can feel that sometimes at Tiruvannaloka. Actually, why we're doing what we're doing is to help people be happier on some level. So the Buddha, in his very famous quote to Yash and his friends, he says, I am free from all shackles, whether human or divine. You too are free from all shackles, whether human or divine. Go now and wander for the welfare and happiness of many, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit, welfare and happiness of gods and men. Teach the Dharma that is beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, and beautiful in the end, with the meaning and the letter. Explain a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. They are beings with little dust on their eyes who will be lost through not hearing the Dharma. So it's quite interesting, that particular quote, because he's saying that go now and wander, so spread the Dharma, for the welfare and happiness of many, so for their spiritual benefit, but also for their happy. So the word there is sukha. Out of compassion for the world, which is anukampa, which literally means shaking, vibrating in sympathy with others, for the benefit, welfare and happiness of gods and men. And it's good to keep our eye on that, and to embody that in our own practice as a kind of benefit to others. Because if we're sort of quite dour and miserable about our spiritual life, that's going to communicate to others, and then that's not going to be acting for their welfare and happiness. We have to embody that happiness, welfare, benefit and beauty of the Dharma in our own lives in order to communicate it to others. So having said all that, there's the famous conference that Bhante went to years ago, where he said to Thich Nhat Hanh, who was advising his followers or the people at the conference, that Buddhists should be happy, which is pretty much the point I've just made. And Bhante said, well, you can't always be happy, but you can always be friendly. I don't think we're going to experience sukha, a direct sort of bodily feeling, all the time. It's just not possible, because everything is impermanent. So sukha and dukkha, as Vedana, are always arising and falling. But yes, but we can be friendly. So going back to Bhante, he said, you can't always be happy, but you can be friendly. We can be friendly. And I think we can have a sense that the Dharma has a special quality to it. That even if we're not experiencing sukha as Vedana, we are experiencing the Dharma as sukha in a particular sort of way, which we'll look at. You can be experiencing the pleasures of the path without necessarily experiencing sukha as Vedana, sukha as a feeling. So we can have that sense, even if things are quite tough for us at a particular moment, we can have a sense that the Dharma has a special quality that is more vivid, exciting and beautiful than the world of the senses. I think for me that quality is something along the lines of Gambhir, which means deep, profound. So I had a dream the other night, which I thought I'd share with you. which is that I was in, it was the night, actually, there's just been a private ordination of someone I know in Bajo Retreat Centre in India. And in my dream, I was at Bajo, and it's a men's retreat, so there was a men's order retreat in which this ordination took place. So I was in Bajo, and they were out in the open air, sort of in the middle of the retreat centre, all collected together, and it was just at the point where my friend Gurbaj was being ordained, and Chandrashil was doing it, actually, and he was just at the point where he was putting on the vase of initiation, the little drops of water. But I was back, because I wasn't on this retreat, because I'm not a man, so I was sort of standing back looking in, and Chandrashil, at that moment, he just saw me and smiled and dropped the water in. And as he dropped the water in, I looked behind him to this jungle, and the path opened up. And there was this very mysterious green light in this jungle, very, very rich. It was actually more like Tiruvannamalai than India, in a sort of that very, very green, intense green, lots of different shades of green, and then this light coming through the leaves, this eerie sort of mysterious green light, and this path, a green path through the forest. And that just sort of, that was a kind of vision that opened up just as soon as he smiled and the drops of water went on. Anyway, I don't know what that's about, but I was thinking, oh, that's, in a way, you can have a suggestion of that very, very delightful path, even if you're not experiencing sukha as Vedana at that moment. That's the kind of, there's a sense that there's a path of the spiritual life which is more mysterious and more exciting than anything the pleasure of the senses have to offer. And the way that the Buddha talks about the pleasures experienced on the path is as cumulative, or each pleasure surpasses the other on the path, becomes more vivid, more exciting, more mysterious than the others. So we'll look at a piece in the study material where it talks about the jhanas becoming more and more pleasurable, with nibbana also being the highest pleasure of all. So in another sutta called the Kandaraka Sutta, he talks about that sort of path of pleasure, if you like, as going from the blameless. So this is the kind of pleasure that one experiences when one has nothing to reproach oneself for. I did experience this actually quite strongly at the end of the last retreat here, which was quite difficult. I mean, there was lots of stuff going on for people. And I realised it wasn't ideal that I went to lead another retreat the day that finished. But even though I was a bit tired, I felt quite happy. And I think I felt quite happy, I realised afterwards, because I think although it was quite demanding, the last retreat, I had nothing to reproach myself for. Like, I felt like, on the whole, I mean, you know, no one's ethically perfect, but on the whole, I had behaved skillfully and I'd done my best. And there is a sort of satisfaction of that, even if, you know, it was quite demanding. So there's the bliss of blamelessness. And on the basis of that, one makes lifestyle changes. One decides to live, for example, a simpler life. A more content life, in which case the happiness of sense restraint arises, or the unimpaired happiness, which is actually when you decide to, you know, not stimulate craving, not stimulate grasping, not stimulate aversion, but actually live a simple and contented life, in which case this other... the unimpaired bliss arises. And then he goes through, on the basis of that, that kind of simple life, sense restraint, comes the bliss and happiness of the jhanas. Now, it's interesting, because when I started looking at this material, and there's quite a lot about the bliss of the dhyanas as being the some of the pleasures of the path. But I find it quite easy to skip over. And it's weird, because I was thinking, well, it's not that I don't experience the bliss of the dhyanas. Like, sometimes I do experience dhyanas. It's not absent from my experience. But I sometimes sort of... I think we have a tendency, or maybe I have a tendency, to think it's not a list that particularly applies to me. Which is a bit of a wrong view, I think. And I was thinking, okay, go back to what the bliss is in the dhyanas, and maybe I can look for those elements in my experience. So there's the bliss and happiness of seclusion, viveka. Well, there can be in meditation, and perhaps even outside of meditation, that bliss which comes from not seclusion as in isolation, but seclusion as in... what's sometimes translated as independence of the heart, where you just feel quite content within yourself. As the Buddha said, the monk must look for peace within himself and not in any other place. For when a person is inwardly quiet, there is nowhere a self can be found. Where then could a non-self be found? So it's like that. And then he compares that to being... just as in the sea, in the depths of the sea, there are no waves. So one become kind of still and, just content within oneself. And I definitely experience that quite a lot of the time. Whether I'm sort of physically alone or just in meditation or even just feeling that sense of being quite independent and solid within myself. And then there's the bliss and happiness of concentration, samadhi. So actually as one mind becomes more integrated and sort of draws deeper into something. So I would sort of feel it. It's a bit like all my scattered energy sort of sometimes just come together. And I'm not distracted and my mind becomes more malleable and more easily directed. Well, it's exceptionally pleasurable when that happens. And then the happy dwelling in equanimity and mindfulness, which is upekkha and sati. So, yes, that one is sort of mindful, one's mind is, you have a kind of full picture of what's going on, totally aware of what's going on, recollected in one's purpose, and... not so sort of swayed by the ups and downs of one's experience or what's happening outside you, or just very sort of even. So there's that kind of happiness, the happiness of equanimity, the happiness of mindfulness, which again I think is very, very much within the bounds of our experience. There's that sort of steadiness in integration. So maybe I was thinking about actually trying to make more of an effort to look for those qualities in meditation as a particular kind of pleasure rather than just pleasant Vedana. And the Buddha saw that each realm does have pleasure within it. Well, the higher realms have pleasure within them. There's a sutta where he describes quite vividly the pleasures of each, or the pains of each realm, and then describes the pleasure of Nibbana itself. So he says, it's just like the pleasure of the hungry ghosts. I didn't even think there was any pleasure in the hungry ghosts, but he says there is some pleasure. He says, he doesn't. He says there's painful feeling, actually, in that one. But it's an interesting image, anyway. I'll tell you what it is. So it says you're a bit like you're very, very hungry and thirsty and exhausted. And you come across, you go down a path and you end up at a tree that's got very, very little foliage and a kind of... not very much shade. So you go and sit under that tree. scanty foliage casting a dappled shadow. And you lie underneath the shade of that tree. And I was thinking, well, that's quite a good image for the hungry ghost, because it's sort of, you think it's going to be satisfying, but it's not quite. So I don't know if you've ever had this, like, we're talking about the heat of India here, not the heat of Wales, but when you're in the heat of India and you think, oh, here's a tree, I can go and sit under this tree, but actually it's a bit of a false refuge. It's not really very satisfying. It looks like it's going to be satisfying, but it isn't. But he says the human realm is like being weary, parched and thirsty, and going to a tree which has proper shade, with thick foliage casting a deep shade. And then you can lie and rest underneath that tree. And he said, well, that is pleasure. You're experiencing much pleasant feeling. But he said there's more pleasure even than that in the God realm. So again, this image is quite interesting. He said the God realm is like coming, being scorched and thirsty and coming across a mansion with an upper chamber plastered within and without, shut off, secured by bars with shuttered windows, and in it a couch spread with rugs, blankets and sheets, with a deerskin cover, with a canopy as well as crimson pillows for both head and feet. So you come across this mansion with this really comfortable, cool room, but it's shut off from the world. You're locked in. You're not really seeing what's going on outside you. It's sort of an image of like, it's beautiful, but it's kind of a cage. And that's the pleasures of the God realm. Yes, it's extremely pleasant, but actually it's shut off from the world. And then he said that the pleasures of Nibbana itself, of realizing direct knowledge and the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are the taintless with the destruction of the taints, is like being hungry and like being thirsty and weary and exhausted and scorched by hot weather, and coming across a pond with clean, agreeable, cool water, transparent with smooth banks, delightful, and nearby a dense wood. And then you go into the pond and you swim around, and then you lie in the dense wood, sort of drying off a bit. And he said that's basically Nibbana. It's like the most pleasant experience of all. So he said, you know, don't settle for the lesser pleasures. Go for the higher pleasure. And he said, which we'll look at in the study, he said he was never envious of anyone experiencing pleasure. There's quite an interesting sort of sutta where he's talking about pleasure, and he said, well, he's not envy of anyone in the lower kind of pleasure. And he said, actually, those kind of lower pleasures, a bit like a leper, where you're suffering these terrible sort of wounds and pain, and you go and, which I suppose they must have done, is you kind of cauterize them in the fire, and you get a temporary relief, but then afterwards it's much worse. So why would he be interested in that kind of pleasure when actually he was experiencing something much, much greater and more sustainable? And then he compares his kind of experience of a pleasure to the pleasures of a king, where, the king, with all his luxury and dancing girls and elephants and whatever he has, couldn't just sit there and be happy for an hour, whereas he could sit there for a week just without anything. And it just experienced pure happiness. So he said, yes, my happiness is greater than the happiness of a king. So it's very important that the spiritual life is about pleasure, and it's not a grim slog. It was interesting talking to Karuna Maya, actually, at the Order weekend, and I said we were going to do this theme, because I was hoping we might be ready to come, actually. And she said, oh, that's a really good theme, and she asked me why I picked it. And then she said, I think it's a really good theme because, she said, I've noticed something coming back to the West, which is there's a lot of talk of the dark night of the soul. And she said, it's suddenly like you're not really practicing the Dharma unless it's really kind of grim and terrible. and actually the spiritual life isn't always like that. There is also the bright daybreak of the soul. It reminded me of that lovely Pablo Neruda poem where he said, I wheeled with the stars and my heart broke loose with the wind. And I just think, well, that was my, I remember that poem because that was my experience of coming across the Dharma. So someone gave me that poem quite early on when I came to the Buddhist Centre, and that's just how I felt. When I came across the Dharma, I felt as if I wheeled with the stars and my heart broke loose with the wind. You know, my mum said I had an immediate personality change where, you know, I'd been utterly, dreadfully miserable. And my dad and her were really worried about me. And then I came home from the Buddhist Centre and she said, your face lit up, you were enthusiastic about life, you had something to say, and suddenly you had some friends. Which is why she's forever grateful to the Dharma and to the Sangha. You know, so that's been my experience. And even if it's hard, even when it is hard, there is a quality that does go beyond painful Vedana. That painful Vedana that we can experience sometimes. As Dharma Dinner talks about, as in Dharma Dinner on the Refuge Tree, we'll look at her sutta where she talks about there's a possibility of even having painful feeling without aversion. A painful Vedana that has within it a longing for freedom. And it's interesting, you know, because I did study St. John of the Cross. Years ago, I did a Mitra study project on a comparative study between the Bodhicitta and St. John of the Cross, which I'm not sure you'd be allowed to do anymore, because it wasn't about my experience or anything like that. It was just a comparative study. And actually, that gave me a lot of thought and reflection for a long, long time after doing that Mitra study project. But so I did read The Dark Night of the Soul by St. John of the Cross. And so St. John of the Cross was experiencing probably some pretty heavy, painful Vedana, considering he wrote that book when he was imprisoned for heresy. And he was probably not sure whether he was going to survive it, because a lot of people were killed, because he said you could be one with God, which of course at the time was heresy. So, but actually, if you read The Dark Night of the Soul, it's an ecstatic love poem to God. It's not heavy and miserable and sort of oppressed. It's an ecstatic love poem to God. And the whole point of it is you just have to surrender to the love of God and get yourself and your own thinking mind out of the way. So it's not this kind of grim depression, if you see what I mean. However, he does talk about something quite interesting. He talks about two dark nights, in fact. He talks about the dark night of the soul and the dark night of the senses. And the dark night of the senses comes first. And he says that there comes a point where we might be dissatisfied with the pleasures of the senses. And we don't feel pleasure in the senses in quite the same way anymore. And yet we don't really fully experience the pleasures of the path. So there's a kind of gap, and we've all experienced this, I think, where it does the old things that kind of gave you pleasure don't quite work anymore, and yet you haven't really found your new way. And actually the Buddha says the same thing, so we'll look at a little sutta where the Buddha recognises that there is a need to taste the pleasures of the path before you can really let go of the pleasures of the senses. So, and he said that even he experienced that before he quite had pleasure in the rapture and bliss of the path, he found it very difficult to let go of the pleasures and the senses. So, yes. And the Buddha himself also talked about in his experience, and this is very important, that he talked about pleasure in terms of the middle way. So the middle way as being really the middle way, as really being to do with pleasure. And that the pleasures of the path are above and between the extremes of sensual pleasure and asceticism. So he says one should not pursue sensual pleasure, which is low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble and unbeneficial. One should not pursue self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial. The middle way discovered by the Tathagata avoids both extremes. Giving vision, giving knowledge, it leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nirvana. So the spiritual life is about the unfolding of pleasure, but I think we have to be quite radical in our understanding of what pleasure is, and that pleasure is the middle path between the pleasures of the senses and the denial of pleasure in asceticism. And he particularly came across that view when he remembered the rose apple tree incident, where he spontaneously got into dhyana while watching his father ploughing, and realised that there is a kind of pleasure that is not to do with the senses, and not to do with, or associated with, unskillful states of mind. So we have to discern what that pleasure really is, what the pleasures of the past really consist of, how they are the middle way, and what distinguishes them from the pleasures of the senses. And the Buddha really did advise people to have a look at that, to really ask themselves those questions. He says one should know how to define pleasure, and knowing that, one should pursue pleasure within oneself. And then he goes on to say how sensory pleasures should not be pursued and should be feared. And then he talks about the pleasures of the jhanas, and calling them the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, the bliss of enlightenment. This should be pursued, developed, cultivated, and not feared. So one should know how to define pleasure, and knowing that, one should pursue pleasure within oneself. So it is a path of pleasure, it is about the pursuit of pleasure, but one has to define what that pleasure really is. And there's a whole section on the Anguttara Nikaya where he distinguishes between different types of pleasure. So the pleasure between the happiness of a lay person and one who has gone forth, the happiness of the senses and the happiness of renunciation, the happiness bound up with acquisitions and the happiness without acquisitions, the happiness with taints, arshavas, and without taints, and arshava, worldly happiness, or samsara, or literally fleshy happiness, and spiritual niramasa, or unfleshy happiness. Noble and ignoble happiness, bodily and mental happiness, with and without rapture or pity, pleasurable happiness and the happiness of equanimity, the happiness of concentration and the happiness without concentration, and the happiness based on rupa, form, and the happiness based on the formless, arupa. So he's very, just like Buddhism usually is, he's very precise about how he's understanding what pleasure really is, and which pleasure really is the pleasure of the path, which pleasure is the higher pleasure. So he goes through all those distinctions and says which one is the higher pleasure. And so you really do get the sense that there's some pleasure that is based on the senses, that, as I said, is viparka from previous actions, and vedana, just pleasant feeling, and a kind of pleasure that comes with equanimity or even absence of suffering, which is a kind of slightly different state in itself. And he also says that we can misunderstand pleasure. We can see things that are actually dukkha as sukha. So this is the viparyasas or vipalasas in Pali. The topsy-turvy views where we can get it wrong, where we're deluded, and we can think, oh, this is really pleasant, and actually it's not pleasant, it's suffering. And I think actually I was thinking about that again. I sort of missed that in the Viparyasas. I was talking about Vajrasakhi in the car. I sort of missed that one of the Viparyasas. Like I think about the Viparyasas or Vipalasas as usually in terms of thinking about impermanence. So I think something's impermanent when actually it's impermanent. But actually, I don't think I take on the pleasure aspect of it. I can think that something is pleasurable, when actually it's not pleasurable, actually. It's dukkha. And I think I need to look out for that in my experience a little bit more, where I get it wrong. So yes, so he describes the pleasures of the path. And the pleasures of the path are not just actually jhanas. Again, I was saying to you in Adistana, I was talking to Amalavadra about this all the weekend, and I said about the pleasures of the path. And he said, oh, well, isn't that just jhanas? So unless you're in jhanas, you're not in the pleasures of the path. And actually, that's not what the Buddha said. But he describes quite a lot the pleasures of the path, which are not necessarily jhanas. Including the pleasures of living a lay life, which I've included in the study, which is about just living an ethical, wholesome, upright life. But there's lots of descriptions of the pleasures of the path. There's a whole chapter of them in the Dhammapada, the Sukhavagga. And I think it's really helpful to notice what we find appealing in the descriptions, but also in our experience. I think the one I like the best, because I experience it pretty much most of the time. I was going to say all of the time, but one can't experience it all the time. But pretty much most of the time, I experience the pleasure of faith. The Buddha calls unwavering faith in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha and ethics as nutriments of happiness. That actually, even when I'm experiencing sort of in a way, painful Vedana, I can be experiencing faith at the same time, and that is a source of pleasure in itself. So I think that's the part of the pleasures of the path that I experience most. But of course, you know, there might be other descriptions that really appeal to you. And even though these pleasures arise without an act of will, depending on the preceding factor, one also does need some work to set up the pleasures of the path. So yes, so they arise, it's an augmentative cycle on the basis of faith, joy arises, etc., etc., etc. But one does need some work to set up the preceding factor. So the Buddha said, the noble disciple who desires happiness ought not to pray for happiness or delight in it or passively yearn for it. A noble disciple who desires happiness should practice the way conducive to happiness. For when he practices the way conducive to happiness, it leads to obtaining happiness, and he gains happiness, either celestial or human. So yes, so even happiness, just as suffering depends on conditions, happiness depends on conditions. So if we want to experience the pleasures of the path, we have to set up the right conditions. I think even doing something like just coming on an order weekend, in a way, you just put yourself in those conditions. That's setting up those conditions for that pleasure of the path to arise. And sometimes we forget that because, it's very easy when we're feeling a bit low or something to just not engage with the Dharma, which is actually the opposite way around than what we really should do it. But it's so easy not to do that. So I think there is something about having a real faith in and a real consideration of what is actually going to make me happy, and taking a really good look at that and setting up the conditions for happiness in the right way, practicing the way conducive to happiness. And what will actually transform my mental state? For me, I often think, oh, I just really want to go and watch a DVD, but is that actually the right thing to do? Or is it not? So that's just a consideration. What actually makes us happy? Like deeply happy, sustained and nourished in happiness. Yeah. So I think the basic message is to enjoy ourselves, to look for unworldly pleasure, for unfleshy pleasure or spiritual pleasure, and take an interest in it. And also part of that is noticing pain. So the Buddha says, don't be afraid of pleasure, of spiritual pleasure, of the pleasures of the path. But actually we could also say, don't be afraid of the dukkha of the path either. Sometimes it isn't it isn't smooth and uncomplicated. So one should, in a way, it's taking an interest, as the Satipatthana recommends, taking an interest in pleasant or painful feeling and noticing whether they arise on the basis of skillful or unskillful mental states, whether they're worldly or unworldly pleasures. So just thought I'd end with a little poem from the Buddha, which you may be familiar of with another poet. And I do wonder whether the other poet got it from the Buddha. But anyway, we'll see. So it's called The Guest House. Anyone familiar with The Guest House? So the Buddha said, in a guest house, O monks, people from the east may take lodgings, or people from the west, north or south. People from the warrior caste may come and take lodgings there, and also Brahmins, middle-class people, and menials. It's not a very good translation, menial. He says, similarly, O monks, there arise in this body various kinds of feelings. There arise pleasant feelings, painful feelings, and neutral feelings. Worldly feelings that are pleasant, painful, or neutral, and unworldly feelings that are pleasant, painful, and neutral. And that's all he says. Just notice those feelings, like different guests coming in and out of the guest house.